Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and we're going to take a look at the world of wildlife with our two guests, Jamie Knack and David Drake. Jamie, UW Extension Wildlife Outreach Specialist in Forest and Wildlife Ecology here at the UW-Madison. David Drake, Professor of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at the UW. He's also with UW Extension as well. So it's great to have them come back. They come by every other month usually to talk about all kinds of things in the world of wildlife here in Wisconsin. I know we can talk early bird migration. We can talk about Snapshot Wisconsin and a whole lot more. You may have an interesting observation. You might have a question about what's going on with the wildlife. I hope you'll join in. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. You can post an email at talk@WPR.org. And if you have a wildlife photo, we always love those. Post them on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. David Drake, welcome back.
Thank you, Larry. It's always good to be back.
And Jamie Knack, thank you for coming as well.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Larry.
Well, what about this migration business? What are you seeing out there, or are we seeing much of anything? Which ones have been reported?
Yeah, I think the standard common species that we typically see this time of the year, I was just out shoveling a little bit of residual snow the other morning and heard some cedar waxwings flying overhead.
Yeah.
So they're a very common early migratory return bird at this time of the year. So that's nothing uncommon. And I think Jamie said that she saw a red-winged blackbird at her feeder.
Yeah, I was looking at your Facebook page, and that's the bird you happened to choose to put on there. But, oh, I would say last week, at the end of last week, there was a red-winged blackbird at the feeder. And hard to say. It could have been a bird that stayed this whole winter. It's been such an unusual winter for temperatures and not that much snow.
Yeah.
And or it could be an early return.
Yeah, so some other birds that will come back. Robins sometimes are eruptive species, so sometimes they'll stick around for the winter if it's been a mild winter, or sometimes they'll maybe do a short-distance migration south and then come back up about the same time of the year. And bluebirds seem to be, around. Sometimes they'll, it seems more and more common, sticking around for the winter. Again, if it's a mild winter, or they'll be coming back up soon. And so it's always nice to see it, even though we probably have, I don't know, a couple months of winter left, those early birds coming back. It does give you some hope that eventually winter is going to break and we're going to get into spring.
And it's a bit warmer today and has been the last couple of days, I think, across Wisconsin for the most part. Certainly warmer than normal. Has that have much effect in terms of our wildlife, the warmer weather?
Well, it varies depending on the species or the taxa. So whether we're talking about reptiles and amphibians or birds or mammals and their specific, the way they move and what they need to eat and things like that. So if we think about snow cover, not having snow cover up north for a species like rough grouse, that snow roosts, so they roost in deep snow, or a snowshoe hare that relies on its camouflage, the white coat, or some of our weasel species that turn white in the winter, it can certainly, a lack of snow cover can have an influence. For herptiles, so reptiles and amphibians, concern would be if we don't get the snow depths. Snow provides like an insulating blanket to the ground, so it prevents the frost from driving deeper into the ground, and these animals often hibernate below the frost line. So if we again have very little snow cover and then cold temperatures, or a thaw this spring and then cold temperatures to follow, it can be very detrimental to some of the hibernating herptiles.
Yeah.
Oh, I was just going to add exactly what Jamie was saying. The other issue that's been a little unusual for us this winter here, at least in the southern part of the state, is that we're kind of getting this freeze-thaw going on, but we've gotten a lot of freezing rain. And that ice is not necessarily good for wildlife because it freezes up their food supply. And at least with snow, a lot of the animals can kind of peck through or paw at the snow and get down to the food. But when you have that freezing layer of rain, it's really hard for them to get through that ice layer and get access to the food. And so that's a little, probably a little bit more problematic than anything else this winter. And that's been kind of unusual as well. But, yeah, as Jamie said also, that snow is a really nice insulating layer. It's like a blanket that, a lot of animals rely on that to keep warm and as they're roosting or hibernating or whatever the case might be. But You know, who knows with climate change what we're in for, but yeah. It certainly seems like we may be in more for these kind of undulating temperatures where you go warmer and then colder, and then you have a thaw and you have no snow, and then you have snow and you have ice and things like that. So it'll be interesting to see how some of the responses from the wildlife are over the next few decades as this progresses.
I got a feeling that more of my neighbors are putting up feeders because my feeders are attended as they have in the past. I'm really kind of surprised.
Yeah, it's been interesting the last couple of weeks, too. You know, there's been a week where, I mean, I was filling most of the time here, filling every other day, filling up all the feeders and topping them off. But there's a week where I think I went the whole week without touching the feeder, but it was also the warm spell that we had, yeah. And no snow cover. So they're able to go back and rely on native vegetation to meet their needs, which, again, argues the point that feeders are not necessary. You know, we do it for selfish reasons. We want to see those beautiful birds and have them be visitors to our backyard. But in most cases, they really don't need us to feed them. And given the opportunity, they would choose or select for native plants. So, you know, another thing when we think about what's going to happen in the future here in terms of weather events and so on, is just really to encourage people to plant native trees, shrubs, yeah. Vines, and then also focus on structure. What type of structure can you put in your yard, whether you're building brush piles or maybe even putting up roosting boxes, which mm-hmm. are places where a chickadee or other songbirds would go and spend the evening, making sure you have lots of conifers, spruce trees, like shelter belts so you can get protection from the cold temperatures. So in some cases, it's not a lack of food. It's a exposure that causes wildlife to succumb to the temperatures in the winter.
Thinking about those feeders once more, Tiger and Coco, my two cats, are very disappointed, I think, that we're not seeing, because they're not, I never let them outside, but they're at the window, I bet.
Yep.
And they're a
right.
little cat tree
yep.
and watch.
That's right.
Watch
yep.
and then
right.
sit there and, I can't make the sound that they make when they're looking at the bird, but you know that little kind of thing.
Funny.
Yep.
Well, Dennis in Sussex has a question for you, so let's go there. Hi, Dennis. Have I got Dennis on? Thought I had Dennis on. Oh, let's see. Let's put him up over here. Now we'll try it. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, Larry. I wanted to ask your guest if they've ever experienced watching flying squirrels.
Yes.
Yes.
Yep.
I started doing it this fall. I noticed somebody was eating my corn that I had hung out at night, and I got a cherry tree, and I've seen as many as 9 of them climbing up and down this cherry tree, and now I put my corn out in the evening, and I go out and I regularly watch them. They do their acrobatics.
Yeah. We lost him. Oh, too bad.
Well, I think,
go ahead and comment.
I think we've got enough story from Dennis that we can at least comment on. Yeah, the flying squirrels are really a neat species. I know Jamie's had great experience with them as well, and certainly chime in, Jamie. But I think a lot of people would think, you know, we put corn out and it's gone at night. You might suspect a raccoon would be a common thing. But a lot of people don't think about flying squirrels because you don't see them that often. They are nocturnal species. They are active year-round. And we've got two species in the state, a southern and a northern flying squirrel. But the southern flying squirrel seems to be the most abundant by far, and as a matter of fact, it seems to be pushing the northern flying squirrel further north, and as the southern flying squirrels are expanding north. And so it's relatively rare to see a northern flying squirrel in the state here, but they are just unbelievably interesting animals. We call them flying squirrels, and of course they're not a true flying mammal
right.
like a bat is, but they're more of a glider. So they'll go up into an arboreal perch or a tree perch and jump off there and open their legs and arms and glide with that skin flap that they've got between their legs and arms and their body. And they have these, you know, relatively big eyes compared to their skull because they're a nocturnal animal. And the other neat thing about them that I always kind of think is fun is they've got this flat tail, and they use that flat tail to kind of help steer them as they're gliding through the air.
Their rudder.
So, yep.
Yeah. Their rudder.
But...
Yeah, you can attract them to your bird feeders, or maybe they're already coming. You're just not aware that they are. So a lot of times what folks will do is either run an extension cord from the house, but clip a floodlight and use like a red light, just so it's not quite so bright. And you can focus that onto the bird feeder, and you'll be able to pick up those animals coming and going. The one thing that they need that is often the limiting factor, it's what is not in the area that prevents them from being around your home, is dead trees. They need the snags or those cavities that dead trees provide to be able to roost during the day and to raise their young. So if you can just remember, if you have the opportunity to hang on to your dead trees, don't cut them for firewood as long as they're not a safety or posing a safety risk, best to leave them. There's over 70 species of wildlife in Wisconsin that utilize those dead or standing trees, either for roosting or for foraging and so on. So I'm guessing that Dennis probably has a woodlot and some dead trees in the area that they're utilizing during the day and then visiting his feeder at night. So,
yeah, that's a great point. And just as a last comment, I think the recommendation is maybe 3 to 5 snags or dead trees per acre. So that will give you an indication as to how many you might want around. And because they are cavity nesters, that if you do not have a chimney cap in your chimney, it is likely you might have flying squirrels as well as other cavity nesters like raccoons in your chimneys. So the chimney cap is about $20, $25, and it's a very good investment to put on your chimney. Absolutely.
Let's go to Gary in Ween, I believe.
Yes, thanks, Larry. This is a great show. I love it. I have an incident with a sharp-shinned hawk about 3 weeks ago. I have a big kitchen window facing out towards where the bird feeders are, and I live out in a rural area with a lot of trees. And I heard a thud, and I went to the door, opened the door, looked on the ground, and here was a red-bellied woodpecker which had flown into the window. And I thought, oh, man. And then I looked, and about 6 feet away was a sharp-shinned hawk sitting on the steps right 6 feet from me. And we just sort of had a stare-off for about 10 seconds, and then it flew off. And so I've noticed that sometimes the bird feeders, I'll have lots of birds here, and all of a sudden everything's gone. And so I imagine it was that. Then about 2 weeks ago, here it had gotten a mourning dove right at the feeder, and it was feeding on it on the ground. And I thought to myself, well, I had more work to do outside. I'd just wait and give it time to finish, since the bird was already dead. And I waited about a half hour, 45 minutes, and it was still eating it.
Oh, yeah.
So I walked out. And before I walked out, I looked out, and here that hawk was tearing apart the mourning dove, and about 2-3 feet away, a blue jay and another mourning dove were on the feeder, and then one was on the ground. So I don't know if they thought, well, he's already eating. He's not going to bother us. So then I went out to continue the work I was doing, and so I walked right towards that hawk, and I got about 5 feet from him, and then we just stood there and looked at each other. It must have been 30 seconds. And then he just flew up with the dead mourning dove in his talons and flew back into the more wooded area.
Very cool story.
Well, thank you very much for the story, Gary. And that is exactly what accipiters, the sharp-shinned hawk and the Cooper's hawk, often do. And we get this phone call quite a bit. And homeowners, you know, concerned that's happening. But there's really two ways to look at it. One, that's what these types of hawks eat. And they are predatory in nature, and they're going to be less common than that mourning dove or some of the woodpeckers or chickadees and so on that are visiting your feeder. So one way to look at it is that's a unique observation and a sighting, and in fact, that is what, you know, what they need to eat. They prey on birds, and they usually pick them off of feeders or in the air. And the other option is if that's something that you'd prefer not to be occurring, one of the strategies would be to take down your feeders or remove the feed for a couple of days, and that hawk will move on to a different feeder. Now, it may be just as close as the neighbors. It may be further than that. But if you're not providing that feed, which is attracting the smaller birds, that hawk will look elsewhere to hunt. And then the other thing that just came up in your conversation that I wanted to share is that there's been a lot of research done about feeder placement and birds colliding with windows. And what they're finding is that the best place to put your feeders is either within 3 feet of a window or greater than 30 feet away from a window. It's that area between 3 and 30 feet that when you have a predator that comes by or a bird is startled off the feeder, it's that area that's that distance that's particularly troubling for them, because they have enough speed that when they collide with the window, they're breaking their neck or getting injured. So you might want to think about how you have your feeders, and if it does fall within that, you might want to move them closer so that when that hawk comes by, it's able to just brush up against the window and it's not getting killed. Or those feeders are 30 feet or more away from your window, and the bird has enough time to navigate and move out of the way before colliding with the window. So
there we go. Thanks a lot, Gary, for calling. Appreciate it. Talking Wildlife today with Jamie Nack and David Drake. I'm Larry Mueller, Jill Nador, on-air producer here on the Ideas Network. Coming up at 2 o'clock today, Kathleen Dunn and an environmental reporter talk about President Trump's stance on the environment and what it may spell for the future. Right now, taking a look at the world of wildlife with David Drake and Jamie Nack from the UW-Madison Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology and UW Extension. Let's turn to Russ next in Janesville. Russ, hi. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. How are you guys doing this morning?
Great. Thanks for calling.
A month ago, I got to see some of our newest members of the state, the elk up by Black River Falls there. And you can't miss these things with those great big orange collars and ear tags on them.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the only identifying mark of an elk.
Yeah. Yeah, they're pretty impressive. When I first seen them, I thought, boy, that's a big deer standing there. And as I got up there closer, I said, those aren't deer. Those are those elk. There were three of them. But the only thing that bothered me is how close they were to the interstate, right next to it. So.
Have there been any, David, have there been any elk getting knocked off by drivers?
Yeah, I think, obviously the Black River Falls elk reintroduction is the second reintroduction of elk in the state. The first one, the original one that's been going on for, I don't know, a couple decades is Clam Lake up in the northwestern part of the state. And I believe up at Clam Lake, the number one mortality factor for elk is deer or elk vehicle collisions. Occasionally they'll get taken by wolves. And so it's not uncommon for that to happen here in Wisconsin. And I suspect that that will be the case down in the Black River Falls, especially with I-94 and, that area running through there. I do know a couple of elk in the Black River Falls have been taken by wolves since they've been reintroduced there. And I think it must be into the second or third year or the 5 year reintroduction at that point now.
Yep. So right now we're in the middle of a reintroduction, adding additional wolves from Kentucky. So
elk.
Sorry, wolves. elk. Yes. From Kentucky into Wisconsin. The Black River Falls reintroduction, though, is concluded, and now the additional years of trapping those elk from Kentucky will be added to the Clam Lake to boost that population.
And what are we giving Kentucky?
Rough grouse, I think.
No, I don't know if there's an exchange. I think it's
straight purchase?
Yeah. Well,
I don't know. We'll have to see. We'll look that up and tell you at the break. But I thought it was rough grouse, but maybe not. We'll find out.
We'll find out. In the meantime,
there's confusion amongst the guests.
Yep.
In the meantime, Russ, thanks a lot for calling. We'll go to Bill in Wauwatosa now. Hi, Bill.
Hello, Larry and guest. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I recently returned from a trip to the Panhandle of Florida, and a next-door neighbor that was camping next to us went out and was watching the sun come up to the southeast on the Gulf of Mexico, and he all of a sudden, maybe 40 feet away from him, out of the sand dunes came a large buck with a rack on his head and just ran full steam ahead straight into the Gulf and kept swimming out. And he lost track of him after he thought he was out more than a half a mile out into the Gulf, and stood there and waited for a half hour just because he was stunned to see this. And I had never heard it. He came and exclaimed it to me, and I thought, wow, this is pretty interesting. And I'm wondering if anybody's ever heard of something like that, or was it maybe was it sick, or
might have been chased by something.
Yeah, Bill, so that's a good question, good observation. Jamie and myself and Craven, Scott Craven, were up in Lake Tomahawk in Minocqua a number of years ago out on the boat, and we see this deer swimming through Lake Tomahawk, So it's not uncommon that they swim, and who knows why it ran into the Gulf. I was going to suggest until you told me it was a half mile out, that maybe it just ran out there to cool off a little bit. But obviously, if it was a half mile out, it was going someplace. But I will say this, in addition to the story you told, there's down in the Florida Keys, there's the Florida Key Deer, which is an endangered version of the white-tailed deer, essentially. And those deer, the key deer, they routinely swim between the Keys or the islands down there. And so it's not unusual for them to go in the water and swim, at least with a key deer. I think whitetail deer, you know, they will go into water to drink, or they might wade in the water to cool off, or whatever the case might be. You know, how common it is for them to swim, I don't know, but I know that they do that.
I was in northern Wisconsin muskie fishing on Black Lake, and I heard some dogs barking, and not much later, here comes a big buck and swam right across the lake. No, it's not a big, it's a 150-acre lake, but swam right across the lake within 10 yards of my boat.
I think it's just something, sights you don't expect to see as this deer, especially with a big rack on its head, swimming across the lake. And you kind of do a double take, like, is that really what I saw? But it is,
right.
Yeah. Is it,
yeah.
So
well,
they'll
thank
do that.
You much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Bill. You can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. And don't forget, if you've got a neat wildlife photo, maybe from your bird feeder or just another one that you took, I hope you'll post it up on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. But call in, 800-642-1234. Don in Eau Claire up next. Hi, Don.
Hi. I'm a 94-year-old retired physician. Wanted to check on something years ago, perhaps more than I'd like to admit. There was an article in a journal then called The Proceedings of the Mayo Clinic. At that time, it wasn't all on basic human science research, but there was this article on black bears in which they described the fact that a black bear could enter hibernation, presumably pregnant, and they would have her weight at the time of hibernation began. When she came out months later with cubs, her weight was virtually the same as it was when she went in. And idea was that the black bears had a unique way of recycling water within their systems to provide sustenance for their own longevity, plus providing milk during a period of lactation. And I just wondered if there had been any further evidence on something like that for black bears, whether that is still a living...
The living thing, I remember Bob Ruff was our our bear guy here and did a lot of research on bears, but I'm not sure about what Don's talking about here.
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that article in particular, Don. I do know that typically when bears go into hibernation, you know, they're loaded up with weight. Obviously, they've gorged themselves on food and they've put on a pretty good layer of fat and things like that to get through hibernation, especially the moms who are either going to give birth in the den or nurse. But typically those bears come out of hibernation with a pretty significant weight loss because they've burned all that calorie, all that fat over the course of hibernation. They do certainly, they don't necessarily defecate or urinate in the den so much. So that maybe is what they're talking a little bit about because they're kind of keeping those waste products in their body because obviously with hibernation that their metabolisms drop pretty significantly and they're not processing as much waste because they're not burning as much calorie. Yeah. So maybe that's a little bit what they're talking about. But I'm not familiar with the specific article or the specific I guess, process that article was talking about.
Yeah, interesting, though. Thanks a lot, Don, for calling. Appreciate it. Matt in Superior emailed to ask, what's your opinion on a trap, neuter, return of free-roaming cats?
All right. Well, Matt, you are really opening up Pandora's box on this one. So I think depending on who you talk to, you're going to get a different answer. So I will give you my opinion, and this is from a professional standpoint, not my personal opinion. So cats, for one thing, should never be outside to begin with, especially free-roaming cats. Now, if you want to keep a cat on a leash or something like that, or keep a cat confined outside, that's one thing. But free-roaming cats should never be outside because of the destruction they do to native wildlife, birds, small mammals, reptiles, things like that. And then that's been pretty well documented in the scientific literature. The issue with trap, neuter, and release is that you are preventing that animal from breeding. So that's a good thing. But you're still allowing that animal to roam free across the landscape and be destructive for the remainder of its life, even though it's not procreating. So I think my professional opinion, and typically the people in the wildlife profession, we are not necessarily in favor of trap, neuter, and release. If you want to trap and neuter and keep the animal inside, absolutely. But it's the release issue. The part of that is the release part that we have a real issue with, just because of the destruction on the landscape toward native wildlife.
Let's turn to Marty in Bayfield next. Marty, thank you for calling.
Hello, Larry. I've got a question. A neighbor of mine told me that pound for pound, red squirrels were the most aggressive animal in the woods. And the reason I ask that is because I've befriended some chipmunks this last year. And in the fall, I started noticing one red squirrel around, and I started noticing the chipmunks disappearing. And I was wondering if the red squirrels would enter the dens, perhaps, and the burrows, and attack them, or what this situation would be with that.
Hmm. Well, Marty, I would probably think of other culprits with the chipmunks than the red squirrels. You know, red squirrels are typically going to eat vegetative matter, so nuts and acorns. However, they do prey on bird nests, so they'll eat nestlings or eggs out of bird nests and trees and so on. So it's not that they wouldn't eat meat per se, or take an opportunity that presented itself, but I don't know that they're going to like to go underground. So when they roost or spend time in a cavity, it's going to be a tree cavity. So it wouldn't seem too logical to me to see a red squirrel going below ground to disturb a chipmunk, which they do climb trees, but they're typically below ground for their burrow systems. But certainly red squirrels are, I always describe them as feisty, as far as our tree squirrels go. Yeah. They certainly have a little attitude given their size. But as far as what's happening with the chipmunks in your yard, it could just be a matter of population changes through the years. So you might have had years with lots of food and you know, high litters and numbers, and then those populations declined a little bit as food supplies declined. And maybe they're building back up again. So,
yep. Yeah. There we go.
And I would have to take issue with the pound for pound statement, I guess. I had the opportunity to play paintball with Jamie Nack a couple years ago. And for a mammal, she is one feisty mammal you do not want to mess with in the woods. So for pound, I'm putting my money on Jamie Nack versus the red squirrel.
All right. There we go. Thanks, Marty. Thanks for calling. Owen posted a photo up on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show, of a flying squirrel, and wonders if it is a southern or northern flying squirrel on his feeder near Cornucopia.
Let's see. What county are we talking? Cornucopia. Do either of you?
No, I don't even know where that is.
Off the top of my head, I can't tell you the county.
I can't think of what the county. So there is a way to determine whether it's a northern or southern. Typically, the northern flying squirrels will be larger in body size than the southern. And then it's a matter of looking at the belly fur. And without pulling out a mammal guide here, one of them has white fur for the length of the belly fur all the way down to the skin. And the other one is white on the tip. And then if you were to lightly blow on it, you would see that it's gray or brown at the base of that hair, and that's how you can tell them apart in the hand, but you really need to have them in the hand to be able to do that. What I can add to that is we've had a summer field course where we spend 2 weeks in northern Wisconsin in the Lake Tomahawk or Minocqua Woodruff area, and our students trap flying squirrels, and we have never trapped a northern flying squirrel. So as far north as Minocqua Woodruff, we're still trapping or capturing southern flying squirrels.
There we go. Sarah in Madison has something for us next. Hi, Sarah.
Hi. We just got to go to Banff in Alberta, Canada this summer, and I saw these wildlife overpasses to prevent wildlife fatalities from cars.
Yes.
And I was just, I know there are a lot of factors that would go into implementing that, including fencing the entire way, or, you know, fencing the road, and then obviously millions of dollars. So I was curious if anyone had ever brought that up in Wisconsin, or if your guests could, just not considering money or public opinion or anything, if they could pick up a spot to put a wildlife overpass where they would do that.
Yeah, so Sarah, that I was just going to bring up that overpass along the Trans-Canada Highway in Banff, and I'm glad you got a chance to see that. Did you have an opportunity to go up on top of one of those?
I didn't, but they do post pictures in bathrooms of the bears. Like, people, like, they actually use these.
We had a wildlife conference in Calgary, and we had the opportunity to go up on top of one of those, and it is unbelievably impressive. When you're on top of it, even though you're above the Trans-Canada Highway, it is so well vegetated up there. You really almost forget you're on top of a wildlife overpass. And they've also created underpasses under the Banff Highway or the Trans-Canada Highway. And it's interesting that certain animals prefer to go over to the top of the highway and certain animals prefer to go under the highway. And so I believe, if I remember this right, it's elk, moose, and bear typically go up above over the overpass. And then cougars and mule deer and things like that go under the underpass. And as you said, the only way that that works, though, is that they have miles upon miles upon miles of fencing to prevent the animals from coming on the highway. So the only way, really, for the most part, they can get across the highway is either go under that underpass or over the overpass. And it is really expensive because of the cost of both building but also maintaining that. And here in Wisconsin, I'm not sure that there's ever
been... We have one for salamanders?
Yeah, occasionally people will put culverts and things like that in, which is, you know, a pretty cheap fix. But in terms of what Sarah's talking about, this massive overpass, I'm not familiar of any discussion that's ever gone on in Wisconsin, with the exception of maybe Highway 49 up through Horicon Marsh. I know there's a lot of concern about wildlife mortality on that highway, but I'm not familiar with any discussion where they've created overpasses or underpasses. They're simply, logistically, because of the marsh, it would just be too hard to do that. But it is a really impressive thing to see. And if you ever get a chance to go up there, go look at it. Or at the very least, maybe if you're curious, just Google wildlife overpass and Banff. And it is unbelievably impressive to see what they've created up there.
Maybe.
And it's actually, I should say, it's actually resulted in a lot fewer wildlife vehicle collisions. And that was the whole purpose of doing it.
Yeah. So maybe Joe can find a photo of that on Facebook and post it on our Facebook page. We'll see if we can get Jill to do that. Mm-hmm. Thanks again, Sarah, for calling. Appreciate it. Dan in Milwaukee has something for us. Hi, Dan.
Oh, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Had a question. It's kind of a follow-up to a few minutes back. We were talking about the introduction or the elk in the Black River Falls area. And I know that there was an established wolf pack there prior to the introduction of the elk population. I'm just wondering if that's kind of, what is the thinking on that in terms of the public? Some public people don't really care for the wolves too much, and so it seems like that might be a conflict if people realize that that is a prime food for wolves is elk, and that they might be predating on the elk. It seems like it'd create more of a conflict and problems for humans accepting to the wolves here in Wisconsin. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Jamie?
Yeah, certainly that was part of the discussion with the reintroduction project, and certainly wolves have been a factor with the Clam Lake herd. The hope is that, going back historically, these two species coexisted, and certainly wolves are going to eat elk or deer, or, our typical prey items, beaver. So it's not unexpected that there would be some depredations by wolves on the elk and even the newly reintroduced. What the hope is that these elk will learn behaviors to avoid the wolves and be able to defend their young or their groups from the wolves in the area. And there's also, you know, a research opportunity here too. As one of the callers mentioned, you know, certainly the elk have radio collars on them, but for a majority of the wolf packs in the state, there's at least one collared individual in the pack. So we can look at, through research findings, kind of how that interaction plays out. But there's been a few depredations in the Black River Falls elk herd by wolves, but it, you know, they're also, you know, that's expected. It's expected to have some of that as they acclimate to new surroundings.
Thanks again for calling, Dan. And someone texted in to remind me that Cornucopia is in Bayfield County.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah. Yep. Well, that could be a northern. Yeah,
could be a northern.
Yep, you'd really have
flying
to,
squirrel.
Yep, yeah. You'd really have to have it in the hand to be able to determine.
You're in the range, though.
Yep.
For sure.
And Owen reminded me that Cornucopia is home to Wisconsin's northernmost post office.
Ah.
And the home of the famous ice caves.
Okay.
So I should have remembered that.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
You can only know so much stuff, Larry.
Well, I know things and then I forget them. Oh, boy. Mark and Ripon, your turn. Hi, Mark.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Interesting conversations, as usual.
Thank you.
Say, two things. Once your guest had commented about the possible exchange of elk for grouse with Kentucky, that may be. I do recall, I believe, exchange for turkey for grouse with Missouri reintroduced back in the 70s.
Yep, that
80s.
Is right.
And my question is, I guess in regards to that comment, when I was young in my 20s, I would hear and see and actually hunt grouse in southwestern Wisconsin, and now I'm retired and I no longer see, hear, or hunt them. I was wondering if it was due to the reintroduction of turkey, habitat change, which has changed quite a bit down there, maybe related to climate change, but also change in farming practices.
Yeah. Habitat change is
There's been a lot of research done in the Southwest on the grouse population, and the current Rough Grouse Society regional wildlife biologist Scott Walter, who is a graduate of our department in forest and wildlife ecology, and he was the upland wildlife specialist with DNR for a period of time too, but he at one point in his career was a biology teacher at UW-Richland Center. And one of the projects they did was radio collaring grouse and then following them and looking at mortality. And to keep it kind of short here, but basically finding there's a change in habitat, so there's more fragmentation. There's an influence in terms of predation, as especially the hens moved about from small patch to small patch. They were vulnerable to predation. And then probably a factor just in terms of forests. So grouse need early successional forests and thickets. So as the woodlands mature, they're not going to prefer that type of habitat. So that's kind of the story in the Southwest. It's not a lost cause. We can change that by working, you know, in with neighbors and in larger clusters to change that habitat down there.
Thanks again for calling. Appreciate it. Jamie Nack and David Drake, our guests today. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at Wisconsin's wildlife today with our guests Jamie Nack and David Drake from UW Extension and the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Nice post up on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. Bev posted a really nice close-up of a Wisconsin turkey and looks like a winter scene in the background, so it looks like a pretty recent photo. If you'd like to send your wildlife photo in, I hope you will. You can ask questions on our Facebook page as well. Just go to The Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of our page. And let's see. We've got Todd and Delavan emailed to ask if pileated woodpeckers are usually seen in the Delavan area.
Yes, they are. Absolutely. We, I think, have, 9 species of woodpeckers in Wisconsin, something like that. And the pileated is the largest of them all. stands about maybe a foot tall or so, and you'll not only hear them because they have a very unique call, but you also, as they're drumming or rapping on those trees, it is a very, very loud sound because they're such a large bird. And the other thing about pileated woodpeckers, if you don't see the bird, a lot of times you'll see the chunking out of that tree or the excavating of the wood, and they take very large chunks out with each time they hammer on the tree, because they'll actually, they have a bit of a chisel point on the end of their bill, and as they hit it, they also turn their head to the side, and so they really can chunk out big pieces of wood. And a lot of times on dead or decaying trees, if pileated woodpeckers are around, you'll see it almost looks like, you know, a pile of wood scraps at the bottom or the base of that tree, and that's an indication you've got pileated woodpeckers around. And as Jamie mentioned earlier when we were talking about dead trees or snags, woodpeckers are called primary excavators, but then you have secondary excavators like squirrels and things that will come and enlarge the holes in the tree. But those primary excavators are one of the species, like woodpeckers, that really get that tree started so that it is very conducive or habitable for a lot of other species. And like Jamie said, you know, 70 to 80 different species have been documented to use snags just here in Wisconsin alone. So it is really a very impressive habitat management practice to leave those snags around. And if you do, you might get pileated woodpeckers.
Bob in Kenosha, your turn. Hi, Bob.
It, again, thanks for taking the call.
Yeah.
I just wonder if your depth to comment would be twice in the, I think one first time was 05 and then again in 08. I'm going on vague memory. I had a wolverine encounter in Northern Forest County, and both times I was still hunting. I was alone, and I wonder if anybody else, I know there's a lot of talk of it, but for sure, I know what I saw, and I wonder if you could comment on that.
Yeah.
So, Bob, we've learned a long time ago to never say never with callers or listeners or people who email and send us pictures. So what I can tell you is that from verified documentation in terms of DNA evidence, verified tracks, trail cameras, which hopefully we'll talk about, too, with the new project going on, we've not documented wolverines in Wisconsin for over 100 years. And so they are considered an extirpated species. So not extinct. They're still in North America, but they were a species that was native to Wisconsin, but no longer resides in the state. I would hesitate to guess that what you may have seen and what you could look up would be a fisher, would be an animal that is often mistaken for a wolverine.
Which I've seen my share of fishers.
Sure,
also.
Okay.
But we'll also say that during my encounters of other things, still hunting, and I'm a pretty good still hunter, bobcat, just my ability, I guess, to stay low and had many wolf encounters too, daytime wolf encounters. So I know what I saw, and I guess I'll have to put that under my hat and wait for the next one.
So I know, you know, another possibility that's always out there is a captive animal that's gotten out from a facility, and that happened on Beaver Dam Lake. This was a couple of decades ago as well, and there were some ice fishermen that had taken a picture or had some type of documentation, but they had seen a wolverine going across the ice, and were able to report it, and they were able to track that animal down as an escaped animal that was a captive held, so it wasn't a wild animal. So,
pretty neat.
Yeah,
pretty neat.
So again, we can never say never, but with all the trail cameras that are out there now, if we're ever going to detect the presence of something rare and unusual like a wolverine or a spotted skunk, now's the time. So,
yeah, that's for sure. Yeah. So get a photo if you see one, for sure.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, most of us have cell phones these days in our pockets, even when we're out in the middle of nowhere. And usually the camera will work even if you don't get cell reception. So if you see that again, Bob, definitely try to at least get a picture with your cell phone and send it on.
Yeah, for sure. And speaking of photos, we did want to talk about Snapshot Wisconsin, maybe in a bit more detail. It's been going on for, I think, about a year. A
couple of years, yep. Well, yeah, it's been a work in progress, but to the public, about a year. So to me, this is just a fascinating, it is a huge, huge project. So a lot of different partners from UW Extension to DNR, University of Wisconsin-Madison with our department, Zooniverse, Alder Planetarium, and then lots of different funding sources from NASA grants to PR dollars and so on. But the goal with this project is a partnership to monitor wildlife year-round using a statewide network of trail cameras. And so this is a true citizen science program project at its best. We're looking for public to step up and host a trail camera and then be able to use those photos to categorize wildlife in the state and eventually be able to help management with things like, let's just think about like the distribution of wildlife. We're wondering about bobcats and how far south, or if they've come from the south, how far north they're traveling into Wisconsin, black bear populations. We're always looking for new methods to survey or index like our otter population or beavers, our fawn to doe ratios. There's a lot of different potential for this project to provide wildlife management information for managing the state's natural resources. So you have two options to get involved, or two ways to get involved. One is you can apply to host a trail camera. So the trail cameras, if your application is accepted, are provided to you. You don't have to purchase one. It's provided as part of the project. And then you agree to download your photos and some things like that. And there's training sessions, a workshop that you would attend. So right now, the opportunities to host a camera are being rolled out on a county-by-county basis. So there are 9 counties right now where they're looking for volunteers to host a camera. And that could be if you have private land, 10 acres or more, or you have access to private land for somebody who is willing to let you host a camera there. And then also as educators, anybody in the state that's an educator, regardless of county, could host. And then also any of the tribes or tribal lands where there is access that can be given is open statewide. The other 9 counties, I'll just read these off, that are open right now are Dodge, Iowa, Iron, Jackson, Manitowoc, Racine, Sawyer, Vernon, and Waupaca County. So if you own land in any of those counties and you'd like to host a camera, the best way to do that is to go to the DNR's website and in their search engine, just type in snapshot, and then you will find information on how to apply, how to fill out the information on how to apply. However, even if you don't own land in those 9 counties, all 72 will eventually be released to host a camera. So you can go ahead and fill out an application now. And then when your county is released, they'll contact you and get you set up for a training or a workshop. And you can also subscribe to their e-newsletter and stay up to date on the project. So that's one way you can get involved with by actually hosting a camera. And the other is you can help categorize the thousands, almost millions. I think they've done 8 million photos already. And that is done through a site called Zooniverse. And so when you go to Zooniverse, there's projects all over the world, but this particular one is Wisconsin-based. But you sign up as a volunteer. There's the training and tutorial for you on how to do it. But essentially, you look through photos and categorize what animal you're seeing. In some cases, it'll be, you know, is it a fawn, or, you know, ages or numbers of animals within the pictures. And so they need help classifying these. So to this point right now, just a little more than a year into Snapshot, they've had 390 volunteers enroll. They're monitoring 578 cameras right now, and they've classified 8 million photos. So it's just a really cool project. And if you get signed up for the e-newsletter or you go on the Zooniverse site, some of these photos are just fantastic. Yeah.
And I think they want to ultimately put out 6,000 cameras across the state. So
it's a huge number.
Yeah, it's a big number. So if you definitely sign up, and don't feel like you're going to miss out, because there's going to be so many opportunities to put cameras out that they're really going to need a lot of people to help out with this.
John in Sturgeon Bay up next. Hi, John. Thanks for calling.
Hi, great program, guys. Kind of a little bit, my wife and I run a wilderness guiding business right up in the area. You were talking about Larry's Black Lake, Clam Lake area. and something that we've been thinking about a lot, and that is sometimes I think we lose sight on how many animals is really the best that we need to bring back, you know, because we can. And I think back, you know, everything from geese to maybe cranes to even now black bears and things where they go from being really cool to being kind of just too many of them. I think, you know, the idea of, for me to chase grouse for turkeys just kind of makes me just shiver a little bit, and, you know, like we used to do. And because turkeys, I think, are that way in a lot of areas. And with the elk population up where we are there's about 165 animals right now. And we were at the rendezvous, and I asked the question of the DNR person that was there, Day Lake, there at the rendezvous, and I said, what's the goal? And my jaw dropped, and they told me the goal for that herd is 1,300 animals. And I thought, I couldn't in my wildest dreams imagine 1,300 animals in that landscape and have it not be more of a negative than a positive for the people who are up there and the other. I don't know. So that just kind of makes me think a little bit that sometimes we lose sight a little bit on what's, you know, geese used to be really cool to see, and now they're, you know, kind of, they've lost a lot of their kind of their lore and kind of what they represent.
Well, thanks a lot for calling, John. David, do you want to take about 30 seconds?
Yeah, I think we got coming up on a break here. But, John, maybe we can continue this after the break. But that's a very interesting perspective, and you're absolutely right. From a wildlife perspective, we are also concerned that we go from viewing these animals as very, very majestic to viewing them as kind of just a pest species. And white-tailed deer in the eastern half of the United States is a good example of that, where people, instead of looking at these animals as a really majestic, beautiful animal, are referring to these animals in places where they're severely overabundant as rats with antlers. Yeah. And it's really a shame when we get to that point. And maybe we can talk a little bit more after the break about that.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. Definitely we can visit that again. David Drake and Jamie Nack, our guests today, will take a quick look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store, and then we'll be back. Stay with us. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking wildlife with Jamie Nack and David Drake from UW Extension and the UW Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. As we broke for news, we had a nice question about a population of animals and is too much of a good thing? And you were addressing that, David, but you want to make some further comments?
Yeah, I do. I just want to finish that comment up really quick, Larry. And, for wildlife, it all comes down to managing habitat. And habitat is just food, water, shelter, and then space. And, for a lot of these species, especially in the urban, suburban setting, we have provided so much abundant, directly and indirectly abundant habitat that these animals are really doing very, very well. And that is a lot of times the case where you have a lot of human beings, whether you consider it an urban area or not, yeah. If people are feeding them directly or indirectly or doing something to the habitat, whether you're aware of it or not. And so that allows animals to achieve the reproductive potential. And then especially in urban, suburban type areas, we get into situations where we cannot cost effectively manage or regulate the growth of these populations. And so you do get into the situation where you have too many of a good thing. And at that point, sometimes people's opinion about these animals change from really enjoying seeing these animals to viewing these animals as a pest. And that's as a wildlife professional and certainly an agency like the Department of Natural Resources, they're always trying to balance that viewpoint there from showing enough of these animals that you keep people interested, but not so many that they become a pest and really create a lot of negative consequences. And the last thing I'll just say about the Clam Lake elk herd is elk reintroduction is ultimately what the DNR wants to do is have a self-sustained population that can be hunted where you can sustain a harvest every single year. And so that's one of the reasons that the population goal for that Clam Lake herd is 1,300 is because they want to be able to have a sustainable hunting population of elk up there.
Hmm. John in Pewaukee has something for us. Let's go there. John, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Hi, everybody. I broke in. I turned on the radio when you were talking about the pileated woodpecker, and it started me wondering about everybody loves pileated woodpeckers. And I think everybody would love ivory-billed woodpeckers if they're still here, and imperial woodpeckers and passenger pigeons and Bachman's warblers. But sadly, they're all gone. And I heard John from Sturgeon Bay, I believe, asked the question or proposed that there's a point at which there's too many animals that can, or a beautiful animal could become a pest. And it actually kind of horrified me. And when I was listening, and I had my question formulated before I heard that. But my question relates to those ideas. E.O. Wilson recently proposed, and I think he proposed, that we set aside half of the earth, half, it was either 25% or half, for just animals. When we talk about too many animals, the reason I kind of, my heart skips a beat is, aren't there kind of too many humans? And when will we take heed and maybe consider the fact there's maybe too many of us, and how do we get from where we are now, which I believe is over the carrying capacity of the earth, just took out oil-based fertilizers and things like that. You could argue very easily that we're over the carrying capacity. When are we going to get serious about taking heed to someone like E.O. Wilson and setting aside land just for animals, the forest, for the trees, if it were?
All right. Thanks for calling, John.
Yeah, John, that's a good question as well. You know, and I'm going to try to tackle this without getting too philosophically deep on this one. But, you know, I understand where E.O. Wilson's coming from. And E.O. Wilson, if for people who are not familiar with him, he's a Harvard ecologist out there and talks about some of these big ideas about going back. To some extent, I would maybe think of E.O. Wilson more as a preservationist than a conservationist, per se. But the issue nowadays is we really can't put the genie back in the bottle. And there are very few places, I think, in this world that have not been touched by humankind, again, either directly or indirectly. If you think about acid rain or climate change or whatever the case is, and to set aside half the world, I think it would just be too difficult because there's not a place in the world where people aren't living, and you're not going to be able to upset people's lives to find that much land for wildlife. And even if you were, there's no telling that you're going to be able to restore wildlife to what it was like 100 years ago, where there was more balance out there in nature aside from the human population. And I think it's just too difficult right now because we've just upset that balance in nature too much. And to go back to more of a preservation standpoint, I think, is going to some extent, cause more problems than if we actively manage it from a conservation standpoint.
I think one of the weird examples, you might say, is Chernobyl.
Yeah.
Where the population went from, you know, to zero.
Yeah.
And buildings and all that, you know, just left the way they were. And now all that's gone back.
Yeah, that's right.
Into nature and the wildlife in that area.
Yep. And apparently the demilitarized zone between North and South Korea is very much the same way because there's no human population there. And the biodiversity there is supposed to be pretty impressive.
Yeah.
But so, yeah, but to find a large enough expanse in the world like Chernobyl or the demilitarized zone is just going to be impossible in this day and age.
Bob in Wauwatosa has something completely different. Let's go there. Hi, Bob.
Yep, hello. Thank you for taking my call. We have a log cabin, and the last 4 or 5 years we are in the woods, and the woodpeckers are just working on the north side, which is closest to the woods. 4 or 5 years, like I said, now there's a large hole, probably the size of an orange. How do we keep woodpeckers away from a building?
So, Bob, this is a seasonal, this isn't a year-round home, is that correct?
It's a year-round home, yes.
It is a year-round home. And yes. Do you see more damage in the fall or the spring or both times?
All year long.
All year round, okay.
Actually, in the winter, we hear them now also.
Okay,
well, unfortunately, the difficult part with this is that this is something that's been ongoing for a while. And one of the things when people are having problems with woodpeckers that we often relay back to them is that it's an issue that you want to solve as quickly as you can, or in terms of addressing it immediately so that you can scare those birds away. So there's two reasons why woodpeckers are pounding or drilling holes. One would be that they're eating insect larvae out of that siding. So especially T111 plywood siding that has channels cut into the wood, insects will burrow in there. And the woodpeckers are drilling through those channels to get the larvae. Another reason would be males, primarily in the spring, that are doing territorial hammering. So they're hammering to let other males know that this is their territory and they've staked it out. So there's two different reasons. Mm-hmm. It sounds like it's probably a combination of the two in your given situation. Oftentimes, the damage occurs on one or two sides of the house. So it does tend to be localized. Has that been the case for you? I think you said the north side?
Correct. And it's the house has been up for 19 years and the wood's stained and this never a number of times. So I don't know if there's any insects. I kind of doubt that.
Yep. So that is one thing to investigate, is to have somebody come out and look, you know, have a pest control company come out and look. It's possible to be able to get rid of that insect or that food source. And then the other option is you could try to exclude them from that area. So whether you're putting out a tarp or a piece of canvas, just kind of walling off that area, hoping that they will leave and allow you to be able to repair that damage. The concern I have is just that this has been going on for a long time. It's going to be really hard to kind of encourage them to leave.
I do see them and open a window or walk outside. They fly away, and
Yep. So the traditional mixed approach. So you can bang on the pots and pans. You can take monofilament line and hang compact discs, so the CDs or an aluminum pie tin, things like that that move and create reflection. You can put the rubber snake. You can hang a fake spider. You can do the owl decoy. But you need to do a number of different tactics. Pinwheels, anything that causes a scare to them, whether it's visual or making that noise, can be effective to drive them off. So you'll need to take some of those steps. And then also the exclusion that I mentioned. But if this does still, you can't get on top of it, you can call the USDA Wildlife Services. There's offices in Rhinelander and in Waupun, and they can issue a take permit because woodpeckers are federally protected. It's illegal to harvest without a permit, but that is something down the road that you can seek to get. The other thing I'll mention is that we do have a series of extension fact sheets, and they are at wildlifedamage.uwex.edu, that website. And there's a publication on woodpeckers, and that talks a little bit more about the control and management of woodpecker damage around the home.
Yeah, very good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Allison Elkhorn emailed to say she's heard rumors that the wolf pack in the Colburn Wildlife area was the animals were euthanized. Is that true?
So that particular wolf pack was in the news a little bit because there were some encounters or some bold wolves that were in that public wildlife area. I have not heard, nor do I think that's true, that they've been euthanized, and mostly because wolves are federally protected or are a listed species in Wisconsin right now. So we would not be allowed to manage them in that manner.
And Edie and Baraboo called to say there's a live feed webcam that shows wildlife using overpass and underpass of animals migrating in Pinedale, Wyoming. And you go to trapperspoint.com and take a look at that. So maybe, Jill, we can post that up on our Facebook page, that trapperspoint.com, and take a look at that.
Yeah, I bet you'll see antelope out there.
Yeah. I know the one in Banff, too, those crossings that they put trail cameras on the openings as well and kind of monitor what's coming and going. So I'm sure those pictures are probably on a website somewhere as well.
And Paul sent a couple of really nice photos of bald eagles to our website, with really nice ones. And then Dave sent us a nice photo a Cooper's Hawk in flight near his home, I think.
Yep. It looks beautiful. Yeah. That Cooper's Hawk in particular looks gorgeous.
That's a very nice picture.
Yeah. Very nice picture caught in flight. So,
speaking of bald eagles, now's the month, too. I think Prairie du Sac and the bald eagle watching.
They just did it in January, didn't they?
Yeah, we just went through that. Yeah.
But there's continuation, I think, into February for some of the different opportunities for viewing them along the major riverways.
Yes. Julie and Eau Claire up next. Hi, Julie.
Hi. I just like to comment, like with everything, there's pluses and minuses. Thank goodness on the farm we have the cats. For every bird, they get 20 mice and those darn voles and gophers. You know, and as for stray cats, there needs to be education. People need to be responsible and take care of their cats, you know. Farmers are among the worst, and I'm a retired farmer. They do not, they like to see the kittens, and then, you know, they let them. And, you know, there's far more birds killed by the modern farming practices, you know, cutting that hay so early. It's rare to see a bobolink, meadowlarks, pheasants that are nesting in the hay fields and everything. So I just wanted to put in a word for the poor kitties.
Okay.
Well, Julie, you sound like a very sweet soul. But the issue still with the cats being out, and I understand, especially in a farm setting, that a lot of people look at cats as a very good kind of pest control option. But the problem with the cats is they're not judicial in what they kill. And you did mention they, you know, for every bird they kill, they might kill 20 vole or whatever. But, you know, those voles are also very good for a lot of other species that are feeding upon them and things like that. And so the better thing is just really to keep those cats indoors, and it's healthier for the cats as well. I think if you talk to veterinarians, that they would also recommend that you keep the cats indoors from the health of the cat's standpoint.
Yeah, the indoor cat will live twice as long an outdoor cat. But good points, though, Julie. Thank you so much for calling. Jeff in Appleton emailed to ask about the DNR policy on beavers. He grew up in northern Marquette County. Enjoyed fishing for trout on small streams. Back then, there were lots of beaver dams where you could catch good-sized fish. The DNR trapped out the beaver and destroyed most of the dams, and now trout fishing is terrible. Isolated spot or what?
Yeah, I think, you know, the issue with beavers on trout streams is obviously beavers eat trees. And the trees are very valuable in those trout streams to keep the trout, to keep the water, the stream shaded. Trout is a cold water species, and what happens with beavers in trout streams is as they not only back up that water, but also eat all of the trees down, that water temperature starts to increase in temperature, and it gets too warm for trout to be sustained there. And so that's why the DNR, in conjunction with the USDA Wildlife Services, trap beaver off of trout streams, is to protect the trout and in particular, the water temperature. So, yeah, I'm not sure exactly about what's going on in your location with trout, because I know that, you know, there's a lot of management of trout, trout streams, trout species, and, you know, stocking and things of that nature of trout in Wisconsin, because it's just such a popular activity. So maybe there's something going on locally with your trout, but I didn't, you know, generally trout fishing is pretty good around the state.
Madeline and DePere, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I have a question. There are so many deer ticks in Wisconsin and this whole area, surrounding states. And I've heard that that there's, you know, like the deer ticks back east are so bad that some of the islands off the East Coast, they totally eliminated the deer because of the Lyme disease and the other diseases. And but here I saw on Wisconsin Public Television, and they sound like they were going to be doing some kind of a test where they were going to put poison in deer food and then have deer feeding stations that would kill the ticks when they fed on the deer. But my concern is, if they're doing that, is that poison going to affect the deer and the people? And my feeling is that if they would just allow more deer to be hunted so you could get the herd way down, you know, to a manageable amount, it would be better for the people and the deer. And could you
comment on that?
Talk about that.
Yeah, okay.
Wow, we could spend a lot of time talking about some of the comments there. So I am not aware or did not see that TV show or that article. Just given the state of Wisconsin and the fact that we're battling chronic wasting disease and that we have a baiting and feeding ban in a number of counties, and those baiting and feeding bans for deer are really put in place to minimize or reduce the amount of contact that deer have with one another, because CWD, that chronic wasting disease, is passed through contact and through feces and saliva and environmental conditions. And we know that baiting and feeding deer concentrate deer, so it facilitates that spread of the disease. So as a result, there's a number of counties where we cannot bait and feed deer in Wisconsin. So then, I don't want to say that this isn't in Wisconsin or, you know, where you got the information, but I've not seen this study looking at feeding deer as a means to kill ticks at feeding stations. It could be that it's being done in a laboratory setting or a captive setting, but I don't see us doing this in a wild setting because of that chronic wasting disease that we're concerned of. And in terms of deer and deer populations, and especially as they pertain to tick-borne diseases, we've got over 1 million deer in the state. We've got 600,000 licensed hunters, and you know, hunters are only going to take so many deer to begin with. So we are still managing social carrying capacity with our deer herd as well. And there are still a number of people who would like to see that number, you know, more deer in the state. And there's stakeholders who want to see fewer deer in the state. So managing deer is certainly contentious. And I guess the last thing I'll leave you with as far as ticks go, and we are in a hotbed for the variety of ticks and diseases that they cause in the Midwest, is really to look towards avoidance techniques for yourself. So checking and applying insecticides and repellents and things like that. So we're really looking at how do we reduce the tick population and self-checks and so on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'll just quickly add on to that. It's been a number of years since I've looked at this literature, but the last time I looked at this, the scientific literature was mixed on deer density and Lyme disease incidence. So some studies out east have reduced the deer density, and they still see high incidence of Lyme disease. Other studies have reduced the deer density, and the Lyme incidence have gone down. So I don't know that the scientific literature out there is conclusive on, even if you do control the deer population, that you're going to get rid of Lyme disease or tick-borne diseases.
Yeah, there we go. Thanks, Madeline. David, I'll give you a chance. You have a quick question.
Yes. I'm in southwest Wisconsin. We live on a mature woodlot. We have resident population of barred owls and long great horned owls, but my wife took a picture of an owl on our lower deck about a month ago that we both think is a long-eared owl, and I was wondering if all three of those would occupy the same woodlot.
Yeah, they should. They could, for sure. And I'm trying to think back on some identifying marks of a long-eared owl. Obviously, the ears are the big one, and it's all relative, right? It's how long is a long-eared owl versus a great-horned owl? Mm-hmm. But if you look in your bird book, and that's what I would suggest, maybe go to a bird book and look at long-eared owls versus great-horned owls. But it is possible that you could have all three of those there for sure.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you so much for calling. And, boy, we're out of time. Jamie and David, thank you so much. You'll be back on April 5th.
Sounds good. Yeah. Looking forward to it.
Right around tax time. There we go. Jamie Nack, Wildlife, UW Extension Wildlife Outreach Specialist. David Drake, Professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology, also UW Extension Wildlife Specialist as well. Great to have them along. They're back on April 5th. Tomorrow at this time, we'll talk about sweetheart scams, tax ID theft, and a whole lot more with our consumer protection experts. So hope you can join us for that. In the meantime, stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network.